Democrats and Republicans are sharply divided over President Trump's phone call with Ukraine.
Like any mafia boss, the president didn't need to say, "That's a nice country you have. It'd be a shame if something happened to it," because that was clear from the conversation.
If you impeach a president over this, then you'll never have another election. This will be tit for tat every time, and that's all this is.
I'm Matt Katz, and today on The Takeaway for September 26th, we'll try to make sense of the latest in the House impeachment story and get a GOP member's take on President Trump's dealing with Ukraine. And 1 year after Justice Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed to the Supreme Court, a political activist who confronted Senator Jeff Flake reflects on the fight to give a voice to women who have survived sexual assault.
Courage is a currency that is contagious. When you are in the presence of someone who is doing something difficult, something courageous, you feel invited to do the same.
Okay, let's get started. Today, we're starting with the hearing on Capitol Hill of Acting Director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire.
I am not familiar with any prior instances where a whistleblower complaint touched on such complicated and sensitive issues, including executive privilege. I believe that this matter is unprecedented.
Yesterday, we were presented with the most graphic evidence yet that the President of the United States has betrayed his oath of office.
This latest gambit by the Democrats to overturn the people's mandate is unhinged and dangerous.
I think that the decision by the President yesterday to release the transcripts of his conversation with the President of the Ukraine is probably unprecedented as well.
That cannot be an ultimate shield against transparency. It can't be an ultimate shield against accountability. The president is not above the law.
Now, we've seen this movie before. We've been here all year on litigating impeachment.
Many Americans have seen this movie too many times, and they're tired of it.
At any point during this process, did you personally threaten to resign if the complaint was not provided to the committee?
No, Congressman, I did not.
Okay, and I will say to my colleagues sitting here, I think you're nuts. If you think you're going to convince the American people that your cause is just by attacking this man.
Did you ever speak to the president about this complaint?
My conversations with the president, because I'm the director of national intelligence, are privileged.
And somebody's leaking this, and it's likely coming from the agencies that you oversee?
The complaint was referred to the Judicial Department for criminal investigation. This was not swept under the rug.
Before the hearing got underway, the House Intelligence Committee released a declassified version of the whistleblower complaint. In it, the whistleblower writes, quote, "In the course of my official duties, I have received information from multiple U.S. government officials that the President of the United States is using the power of his office to solicit interference from a foreign country in the 2020 election." Later in the hour, we're going to hear from Republican House member Phil Rowe on President Trump's phone call with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. But first, we're going to get the latest on the story from Max Kuttner, who covers the FBI, Justice Department, and Russia probes, and Rebecca Ballhaus, Wall Street Journal White House reporter. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, Max, I wanted to start with you. Was there any new information revealed in this hearing, in addition to the whistleblower complaint made public this morning? It seems that much of the questioning was focused on the process of how this complaint was handled, right?
Yeah, Matt. A lot of what the past couple of hours in the hearing have dealt with was more about the process. It was trying to find out whether McGuire went to the White House first about this complaint, whether he went to the Justice Department first. Less was about the actual details of the complaint. In fact, it took about 2 hours before Democrats on the panel really tried to get McGuire to talk about those details, and even then he wouldn't really answer. Especially at the beginning of the hearing, it for what seemed like an endless amount of time, the lawmakers were questioning whether he went to the Justice Department first or the White House. First, he said he went to the Justice Department. Then he corrected that and said it was actually the White House. And lawmakers then followed up with, why would you go to the subjects of a complaint that complaint to get permission on whether to move forward with it?
Mm-hmm. And he also said he hadn't referred this complaint to the Congressional Intelligence Committees either, right?
Right. He made clear that he had referred it to the Justice Department. He talked about how he talked about his decisions for why he didn't think it should move forward to the congressional committees, that being because it potentially contained privileged conversations involving the president, and also because it did not fall under his purview in the intelligence community.
Got it. So that's what Democrats were seizing on. And Rebecca, several Republicans were focusing on the fact that the whistleblower didn't have firsthand information, that this was coming to the whistleblower from other government officials. Is this a pretty potent argument for the GOP? Are you hearing that also from Republican sources on the Hill?
I think that's certainly the message that the White House and Republicans are trying to push, and that we saw circulated in talking points that went from the White House to the Hill yesterday, is that they want to portray this whistleblower as someone who not only didn't know what they were talking about, but also had partisan motivations. This is important to note, given that it's not clear that anyone in the White House knows who the whistleblower is, but the president himself has been pushing this idea that it's someone who's out to get him. He's been retweeting various tweets accusing the whistleblower's lawyers of having partisan motivations and looking at their record of donations to various political candidates. So that's definitely the way that the president is trying to discredit all the allegations in this complaint, is by just saying that it's coming from a highly motivated source.
Like that it was just a partisan attack, this whole thing just being a partisan attack. Got it. Okay. So we also heard from Republican House member Devin Nunes, and he questioned the leaks that have been made to the press around this story. Can we hear what the congressman had to say?
The intelligence community and the National Security Agency, obviously, you know, they collect things that are to protect.
I just want to make sure, because are we just going to foreign leaders? We might just have either the president of the United States not talk to foreign leaders, or we should just, or publish, just publish all the transcripts, because that's what's happening here.
Ranking member.
So, and somebody's leaking this, and it's likely coming from the agencies that you oversee.
Max, what do you make of that exchange between McGuire and Republican House member Nunes?
This is nothing new, Matt. In all of these hearings, we tend to hear Republicans and from Ranking Member Nunes in particular, they try and steer the conversation towards the leaking. That's been happening a lot during the Trump administration, that kind of rhetoric during these hearings. We also had Nunes call the hearing today an information warfare operation against the president. So clearly they are trying to paint this in a certain light, and I think McGuire answered appropriately.
There had also been reports that McGuire threatened to resign if the White House prevented him from openly testifying in front of the House. Did that come up today?
It did come up briefly. He had disputed that when the report came out yesterday, and he disputed it again today, and then they moved on from that.
Max, what about executive privilege? This is something that the Republicans brought up. How does that play into these hearings?
This is another thing that we hear a lot from the Trump administration members in all of these hearings. They like to assert this privilege. We also hear it from people like Corey Lewandowski when they are not members of the administration, notably. Executive privilege, it dates back to the George Washington administration. There's no federal statute that defines the extent of the privilege, and that's why people have been so eager and have so easily asserted it.
This seems like something that's going to keep coming up as we move forward with impeachment proceedings.
It will. And the Democratic lawmakers in all of these hearings, they always push back on it and try and get the justification for it. They question whether something actually is privileged, but so far they haven't really seemed to broken through to get the answers they want.
Rebecca, have both sides retreated to each side of the fence here? Do you get the sense that the parties, each of the political parties, are united in their messaging when it comes to how they're approaching the whistleblower complaint?
I think that there's certainly an effort by the White House to try and make sure that Republicans close ranks behind them and that there is a message of unity. We saw yesterday, before they allowed the press to see or the public to see the transcript, they invited a handful of Republican lawmakers to the White House to review it. And the president called into that meeting, and essentially it was intended to both reassure Republicans that there was nothing wrong with the transcript, but also to prepare them to go on TV and defend the president after that. But I do think we've seen a couple of Republicans voice at least some concern about what they've read, both in the complaint and in the transcript. I don't think that there's any real merging between the two sides just yet, but we saw Ben Sasse come out of reading the complaint yesterday, yep, say he thought that there were some problems with it. Romney has said he thinks that it's troubling. So we'll see if that continues in the next few days.
And unlike the Mueller report, which some Democrats have been concerned, it wasn't really easy to understand. Do you think that Americans have more clarity on this, that this whole issue is just more digestible to the average American who's not maybe watching the whole hearing but is paying attention to the news?
I think that's a fair description. I think it helps that the transcript yesterday, it's just 5 pages. It's pretty easy to read. And it's pretty clear cut that he brings up Biden. He asks a foreign leader to work with his personal lawyer and attorney general on an investigation into his political opponent. That's pretty clear cut. But I do think where the president is succeeding so far is on making the transcript a referendum on this idea of a quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. And so I've heard from a lot of readers in the last day or so who say, what's the problem with this? There's no quid pro quo in it. He doesn't explicitly say that if you don't investigate Biden, we're not going to give you military aid. And so I think that that's going to be sort of the central tension here going forward, is whether Democrats are going to be successful in messaging-wise in saying that the problem alone is just that he's asking a foreign power for help, not that he didn't necessarily on this call offer aid to or say he would hold up that aid,
right,
or whether the president will be successful on his end.
One of the more shocking revelations from this whole episode is an alleged cover-up undertaken by multiple members of the executive branch to place the transcript of the call between the president of Ukraine and President Trump on a classified server. How has that been addressed in these hearings, Max?
You know, we actually didn't hear much about that. We didn't hear much about these details from the complaint. It really was focused more today's hearing on the process and how McGuire went about working with this complaint. Mm-hmm. We really didn't get into those details. Democratic lawmakers did try and mention them, and in their time, of course, on the stand, were able to talk about that and get some attention to those, but we didn't hear about them from McGuire.
Rebecca, we're going to see more of this type of testimony as the House ramps up its impeachment investigations. Did what we see today set the tone for hearings that we're going to be seeing on our TV screens over the next several weeks and months?
Yeah, I mean, I think that things will only escalate. I think when we're talking about executive privilege, that the White House's repeated invocation of it in the last year is part of what got us to this point. I think Democrats on the Hill are really fed up with not getting any answers. And so I think that now that they have this opportunity, that they're really going to seize on it.
And it's all going to, the backdrop to all of this is going to be the presidential race, which is obviously well underway.
That's right. It's certainly not going to get quieter from here.
Max Kuttner covers the FBI, Justice Department, and Russia probes, and Rebecca Ballhouse is a Wall Street Journal White House reporter. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We turn now to the Republican response to the latest news about Ukraine, the whistleblower complaint, and moves to impeach President Trump. Congressman Phil Rowe is a Republican representative for Tennessee's 1st Congressional District. Congressman Rowe, welcome to The Takeaway.
Matt, thanks very much for having me.
So, Congressman, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, has officially backed this impeachment inquiry into President Trump. And you tweeted your opposition saying that Democrats have been, quote, foaming at the mouth to undermine Trump's presidency from the start. So, do you not think it was at least inappropriate for the president of the United States to ask a foreign leader to investigate a domestic political rival and then to potentially withhold aid from that country if they didn't do this favor for him?
I think this is a lot of a blow about nothing. And one of the things that disturbed me about this, in my previous life, I'm a physician. Mm-hmm. So I try to get all the information I can about an issue before I make a diagnosis. And here the Speaker of the House, before she hears a secondhand description by a whistleblower that didn't read this, and then says this is an impeachable offense before they ever read the document. Well, I would wait to read the document, which I did, mm-hmm. and I read And everything is arguable, Matt. You can argue anything, but no, I do not. I think here's a man who's been investigated for 2.5 years, $30 million, 19 lawyers, and came up with absolutely nothing. And now a phone call to your Ukrainian president is impeachable. And you're creating, what I see happening is the person who did no crime is being accused when it looks like Mr. Biden may have done something that was wrong.
What do you think potentially that Joe Biden did wrong, and how should that be investigated?
Well, if you think about, look, just look at the first blush of it. Flip it around. If this were President Trump had done this, if you are the vice president of the United States, you're in Ukraine, you withhold, you and you say you did this, withhold $1 billion worth of aid going to that country, so that a prosecutor will quit investigating your son, who's getting $50,000 a month from an oil company. I mean, that doesn't look good. This is about, I think, about an election that occurred 2.5 years ago. And look, I heard this all the time from the far right when I was when President Obama was president. I was here for 8 years. He was president. Impeach Obama. I said, for what? We have elections in this country, and we're going to have one next year. And politically, I can tell you, in my part of the country, this will embolden the Trump supporters. I can assure you it will.
I mean, this theory that he was manipulating his own office as vice president to help his son, that has been debunked as false by various news outlets. I mean, do you believe that that's what he was doing, or there needs to be some sort of like formal investigation into finding out if he was doing that?
All I know is exactly what you know. The man said he withheld money, $1 billion, vice president did, so that they would quit this prosecutor who was investigating his son, who's getting $50,000 a month with this Ukrainian energy company. And so, you know, you can draw your own conclusions.
Do you think that President Trump was indeed asking the president of Ukraine to investigate Biden? Do you agree that that's what he was doing in that phone call?
Well, look, you've read this, haven't you?
Yeah, I've read the transcript.
I'm sure you've read the same, and I've read it twice. And basically, it was a congratulatory call of his parliament, and this was back in July. And I think, honestly, Matt, this is going nowhere, and we're going to spend a lot of money and time. Right now, we've got the Middle East as hot as it's been in years with Iran. We've got a USMCA agreement that needs to be worked on, the Canada trade agreement, Mexico-Canada trade agreement. We've got a trade war going on with China that needs our attention. And what are we focusing on? A phone call that's going to end up being nothing, just hysteria among the Democrats. And I think the people in this country see that. And once they read it, look, I asked for it to be released before I knew anything that was in it. I asked for that. I think sunshine is the best disinfectant that there can be. Let people make their own minds up.
I mean, you said that it's going to be dismissed, but there's been some Republicans that are concerned about this. Republican Senator Mitt Romney said that the contents of the call were, quote, deeply troubling. Senator Ben Sasse said, quote, Republicans ought not to be rushing to circle the wagons here to say there's no there when there's obviously lots that's very troubling there. Why are some Republicans more concerned?
It may be troubling to those two senators. It certainly isn't troubling to me. And right here, as I said, if you're going to take, and one of the things that concerns me also is not just this administration, there may be another president, a different president next time. If I were a foreign leader, I'd be very reticent to be on a phone call with an American president, knowing that my conversation, which I thought was private, was going to be made public due to political reasons. So I think that's a concern that I personally have, is that would a foreign leader that he talks to, and when that foreign leader thinks it's a private conversation.
There's just the sense out there, just as you're arguing that Democrats will do anything to get the president out of office, that congressional Republicans will do anything to defend the president, that they will, no matter what were to come out, as the president said, I could shoot somebody in Fifth Avenue and I'd still have my supporters. And there's a sense that the congressional Republicans are not acting as a check on the president, regardless of what he does, and aren't willing to pursue investigations as far as they might take us, because they are concerned that Trump supporters
would. I'll tell you why I will disagree. I'm going to give a shout out to one of my predecessors, Howard Baker, who took down President Nixon. So Republicans actually stood up and took their president on. If there were something here, if you look at my comments about all of this,
yeah,
is let's wait until we get the information. The same thing as the Mueller report. We spent 2.5 years with this thing, and there's a stench about that whole thing at corruption at the top of the FBI and the Justice Department. And yet when the report came out where Mueller says no collusion, the Democrats said collusion, and the very next chance you have is you have a phone conversation that's now an impeachable offense. It seems to me like that's politically motivated.
Congressman Phil Roe represents Tennessee's 1st Congressional District. Congressman, thanks for being on the show.
Matt, thanks for having me.
And I just want to go back to something that Congressman and a lot of Republicans have been saying, that something just doesn't add up about Joe Biden and Ukraine. It all centers on this Ukrainian prosecutor that Biden helped remove from office, which supposedly helped his son's overseas business interests. But
the timeline doesn't add up, because the crucial point there is that the investigation had ended a year before Joe Biden first started calling for this guy's resignation.
That's Josh Kavinsky from Talking Points Memo on with us earlier this week. He spent 3 years reporting in Ukraine and told us the charges are bogus. And when it comes to establishing a link between Biden's actions as vice president and his son's business interests overseas, the Wall Street Journal wrote last week that, quote, in Ukraine, government officials and anti-corruption advocates say this is a misrepresentation. One year ago, a battle was raging over the confirmation of Justice Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. And you might remember this moment, which unfolded in an elevator on Capitol Hill.
On Monday, I stood in front of your office with Addie Barkin. I told the story of my sexual assault. I told it because I recognized in Dr. Ford's story that she's telling the truth. What you are doing is allowing someone who actually violated a woman to sit in the Supreme Court. This is not tolerable. You have children in your family. Think about them. I have 2 children. I cannot imagine that for the next 50 years, they will have to have someone in the Supreme Court who has been accused of violating a young girl. What are you doing, sir?
That was Ana Maria Archila, the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy, confronting Jeff Flake, the former Republican senator from Arizona. This confrontation took place a day after Dr. Christine Blasey Ford testified to the Senate Judiciary Committee about her allegations that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her in high school. Archila's pleas may have played a role in pushing Senator Flake to vote to delay Kavanaugh's confirmation vote until after a brief FBI investigation. That left open the possibility that the committee would side with Ford. Kavanaugh was ultimately confirmed, but Blasey Ford's testimony did spark a national conversation about sexual assault and the treatment of survivors and their stories. Ana Maria Archila joins us now to talk about how this conversation is going a year later. Ana Maria, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you so much.
Let's go back to that encounter you had with Senator Flake nearly a year ago. What compelled you to confront him?
I had been in and out of the protests for many weeks, and I had witnessed in awe as women told their stories of sexual assault for the first time. Many chose to do that in solidarity with Dr. Blasey Ford and as an effort to help the country understand the culture that enabled sexual violence in the first place, and especially the ways in which people who violate others are, and mostly men, are granted impunity from that behavior. And that was exactly what was in display in the treatment that Kavanaugh was receiving. Dr. Ford was not believed. Her story was examined in a million ways. And Kavanaugh was essentially able to show up to the Judiciary Committee and say, how dare you question my integrity? How dare you question my credentials. I deserve to be here. And it was both witnessing the courage of other survivors and being outraged by the repetition of history that propelled me to tell my own story, which I hadn't told in 30 years and which I hadn't told to even my parents.
Wow. And then you told it to the world via that viral moment.
Well, I did not mean to tell it to the world. I meant to tell it to Senator Flake in that moment as he was about to make a very important and consequential decision. I encountered Senator Flake a few minutes after his office had released a press statement saying that he was ready to vote in support of Kavanaugh. And it was the disappointment of watching, of realizing that he was going to repeat history. You can feel and the emotion in my voice and in the voice of the other woman who was in the elevator with me, Maria Gallagher, who I had just met. She had just shown up to the protest that day for the first time, and she had never uttered the words, "I was sexually assaulted." She was working in therapy to be able to say those words, and she, in a moment of intense interaction with Flake, she said those, and she also said, "Look at me and tell me that what happened to me doesn't matter." And those words continue to resonate in the dialogue that we are having in our country about how we treat survivors today.
And you were speaking and representing untold numbers of sexual assault victims in that moment. I'm wondering what it was like for you as a survivor of sexual assault to watch Dr. Ford's testimony and that whole circus of a confirmation process.
Watching Dr. Ford's testimony was both incredibly painful. I could recognize in the cracking of her voice and the effort to keep her composure my own experience. And I could recognize that she was trying to both share generously something that was difficult to share and try to help the country understand the impact of allowing men who violate women to keep functioning in our society and be granted permission to continue. Dr. Ford's story changed the conversation and made the debate not just about the policies that impact our lives, but the way that our government works and whether or not people in power are able to govern by listening and to pause and allow themselves to be moved by the experiences of people that are different from them. And in some ways, her treatment showed that the politicians today that were sitting in the Senate, for the most part, were unable to govern by listening, and they were unable to seize the opportunity that was presented to them to signal to the country that they would not reaffirm a culture that enabled sexual violence in the first place.
Where do you think the opposition to Kavanaugh and the protests against his confirmation fit into the larger Me Too movement? Do you think the hearings and Dr. Ford's testimony represent a beginning of this Me Too movement, a culmination of it? Was it toward the end of it and now we're entering a different era? How do you put it into that larger perspective?
The fact is that women have been fighting against sexual violence for decades, for generations. And many years ago, a woman whose name is Tarana Burke, created a space, both a physical space and kind of a political space for women to tell their stories so that they could begin to heal. And she coined the term Me Too. And about a year before the Kavanaugh protest, that term came into political, kind of erupted in social media, and lots of women began to share their stories. And I asked myself when Me Too first broke into the scene whether I would say something. And I remember I drafted, people were sharing a lot on social media, and I drafted several posts and erased them and drafted them and erased them. I couldn't bring myself to share my own story then. But when I was in the halls of Congress watching women share in detail what had happened to them, in an effort to help senators understand the collective experience of women in this country, I was moved. I was moved. I found the courage in myself, and I understood that courage is a currency that is contagious. When you are in the presence of someone who is doing something difficult, something courageous, you feel invited to do the same. When you are in a place where solidarity is being displayed, you find abundance in yourself and you too can participate in acts of solidarity. And I think that's why I believe that even though we lost the fight around Kavanaugh, there was massive transformation happening in our country
because people witnessed and participated in an act of courage and act of solidarity that transformed their sense of their own power. And at the end of the day, that's how social change happens. It resides not in the hands of politicians who failed mostly to lead with moral clarity. It resides in the hearts of people who listen to the voice inside that says, I must do something.
Ana Maria Archila is the co-executive director of the Center for Popular Democracy. Ana Maria, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, that's it for me this week. Amy Walter is in tomorrow, as usual, and Tanzina is back on Monday. Our show is produced by Ethan Oberman, Rob Gunther, Jivika Varma, Jose Olivares, Jason Tereski, Andres O'Hara, and Meg Dalton. Polly Urungu is our digital editor. Our intern is Lita Hallowell. Vince Fairchild and Debbie Daughtry are our engineers, and Jake Howitt is our director and sound engineer. David Gable is our administrative assistant. Alexandra Boti is our senior producer, and Deirdre Debke is our executive producer. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz. Follow me on Twitter at MattKatz00. This is The Takeaway.